Session number 6245, Reel 2.
Mr. Richards, Reel 2. Returning for a moment, if we may, to the preparation for internment, did you make any personal preparations yourself in terms of valuables, bank account, notifying family at home of likely consequences of Japanese invasion?
No. I probably wrote, well, I did write home regularly, but what I said as it drew towards December 1941, I cannot now remember. All I have for that time is a note made by my father from a letter that I sent out over the border through Dutch hands on the 5th of January 1942, speaking of rumours from Kuching and elsewhere, no news from the Dutch side, explaining that some people had gone over the border, including some of the men, but the Dutch are under orders to stay. And five of us are still here with this companion of mine who went out with me in the first place. And we're all well so far. I'll try and let you know what news I can by this same route. This is January 1942.
Of course, by January, you would have experienced Christmas in a most unusual situation. Do you recall any of the details of that
Christmas? Was not a Christmas at all. I mean, I think I probably went round to the mission where there was an elderly lady in charge, but I can't remember anything about that Christmas at all. We were mostly waiting for the news. Of course, the what happened at the time was on Christmas Eve, the Japanese actually landed in Kuching.
How far were you from Kuching yourself?
As the crow flies, I've no idea. About 12 hours in a launch. Probably only 80 miles. I could hear, round about Christmas time, I did hear bombs, and I gathered afterwards that there was the Dutch Air Force bombing the Japanese ships, of which two still remain as wrecks off the coast.
There had been no prior bombing by the Japanese?
There had been some in Kuching in December, earlier in December. And, of course, in Miri, where the oil fields had been burnt on about the 16th, I think. 14th or 16th, that's 7 days after, six, 7 days after Pearl Harbor. And Manila Harbor was attacked about the same time as Pearl Harbor. Then they moved down towards Miri, with aircraft only, at that stage. And some of the, having destroyed the airfield and money and valuables and so on in Miri, the people left in three ships and they were bombed on their way down the coast. There were several, two or three dead and about 20 wounded, I think, who were cluttering up the Kuching hospital, a small hospital, of course, when the Japanese bombed Kuching about the 16th or 19th of December. And then there's something like 70 wounded, I think.
But prior to your arrest by the Japanese, there was a time lapse of a few weeks.
Between, yes, they landed in Kuching on Christmas Eve and took Kuching the next day. I wasn't collected until the 30th of January. During which time I was simply carrying on.
Did you have any instruction from your superiors about what to do? Or was it tacitly agreed that you would carry on until the Japanese actually arrived?
I as far as I remember, it was tacitly agreed. Of course, there was discussion between us and in the one division. That was the point of our all going up to Lubuganto on the border. This letter of mine was dated January the 5th, so that must be the time we were there, which was, after all, 10 days after Christmas. And we didn't know what to do. But we sat around there and made our minds up there. And as I said, some went over the border and some came back.
The details of your arrest, could you give that to me now?
Yes, I was taken in, I think it was in the small hours. It so happened it was in the small hours. I mean, these things seem to do that. Possibly because everybody was already going by Tokyo time, I don't know. And I was taken in by a local police officer, an Iban, I think. I don't know who was in his party.
Approximately how many were in the party?
His party? Only about four chaps, all locals. And I was wheeled off and with what I could carry.
How much time did you have to make a selection of possessions to take with you?
Oh, till after breakfast. I mean, there was no notice. I suppose one imagined it might happen any day, but nobody rang up if the landline was still operating and said, look, you're expected to turn up and surrender yourself, or we are coming to get you on such and such a day. They simply turned up and they gave me a few hours to get a meal and pack what I thought was sufficient. I didn't know where I was going or for how long, so I took simply what I could carry. They probably advised me not to take too much because they weren't prepared to carry it for me. Fair enough.
So you took a suitcase or two for
me? I took what amounts to... I remember, yes, I do remember. It was one of these zinc carrying packs. Things that had been issued to the armed force of the constabulary in previous years. It was about 2 foot deep, round, flattened one side, with a zinc lid, and it was carried with the straps were two rifle slings. It kept things waterproof, and I put what belongings I could in there. It amounted to a very small suitcase. Because I could carry it myself.
There were no restrictions at this point on what you could take with you?
No. And I don't remember precisely what I did take. Now, I suppose a change or two of clothes and shaving tackle, things like that. I did have my passport and a Bible and a copy of Virgil. Largely, I think, because they were compact and small. I had much bigger books, but I wasn't going to cart them about. And as with all the other people who were interned, we brought in things that we thought we could read and reread and that would last. It was no good taking novels or anything like that.
Now, when you were taken away by the policeman, which I believe you had some dealings before.
Yes, one of the party was a corporal, I think, in the police force in Bataan, actually. And the others came from the divisional headquarters, Smaga.
Did you have the impression that you were being treated as a criminal or was there a state of embarrassment on their part that they were arresting somebody formerly superior to them?
They're very good at hiding these things. Yes, they probably were embarrassed, or some of them were. The leader of the small party, of course, was not, because he was already collaborating, and that was obvious enough. But the people with him were probably in two minds. And they are, after all, realistic people. They realized that the Japanese had taken the place over, but we had ourselves in Sarawak, we had no power with which to do anything about it. Under the agreement of 1888, Great Britain had undertaken the protection of Sarawak, and it was sufficiently obvious that Britain couldn't do anything about it either, for perfectly good reasons. All there was this battalion, I think it was, of the 2nd 15th Punjabis, Punjabi regiment in Kuching. They did what they could, and indeed the survivors finally surrendered at the other end of Borneo, down south, after many, many months of guerrilla fighting. But what can a battalion do against half a dozen ships full of Japanese soldiers, aircraft, and all the rest of it? And the local people realized this. So if in conversation anything like this had come up, I'm quite sure they would have said, well, look, sir, what would you do if you were in our position? Where's my next pay coming from?
And you see, presumably recognizing the realism of the situation.
Yes, one did. No, I didn't feel anything about it. Yeah. No.
You were taken to a jail.
Yes, over in the divisional headquarters at Semangan, where we were put in a cell, three, four of us, adjoining the main cell where all the prisoners were that we had put in our time. And we were well looked after by some Sikh warders who had nephews fighting in the Western Desert at the time, as they told us. The party that had taken over Semangang was led by a local chap who was collaborating and who persuaded them eventually to make him the resident. But there were only four Japanese. There was no resistance, you see.
What form of processing did you go through at this stage?
None at this stage. We were simply clapped inside and fed, as far as I know, by the Sikh warders.
How long did this period in jail last?
Only a few days.
Then you went by cargo boat down to the capital.
Yes, it was a small barge. I mean, it wasn't any bigger than a narrow boat on a canal in England. And we spent one night on the way.
What were the conditions like there, on the boat?
Well, it was simply a barge.
Were you in closely confined quarters? Were you fed?
No, there was plenty of room in the barge. I don't remember that we had any food at all. There was plenty of room in the barge, but it was simply room, because there was nothing else in it but us. So you had 40, 50 feet, or whatever it was, of cargo space with a few boards at the bottom of it, open to the weather, and that's it.
And who were your companions on the journey?
Well, the district officer from Smaga and the rubber regulation officer, agriculture chap, and the Eurasian doctor from the hospital, and the Anglican priest from the mission school.
And what happened on your arrival at the capital?
We were brought ashore on the downriver side of Kuching, near where the Borneo Company premises are, and marched the length of the main bazaars, there's a riverfront shop up to the police station. And for that particular journey, we were handcuffed, not at the instance of the Japanese, but of the collaborators, who I suppose thought they might make a good mark for the Japanese for doing this. The Japanese knew perfectly well it was quite unnecessary. We were taken to the police station, but only briefly, and I think there we were asked our names and addresses and where we came from and what was the colour of our grandmother's socks and things like that.
Oh, can I go back a moment? Because when we last spoke, you referred to the civilian reaction in Kuching to this little procession of handcuffed British.
Yes, I did. The Japanese were straightforward enough. They were in command and they simply bundled us about, but without being cruel or unduly harsh, the collaborating local people were obviously trying to curry favour with the Japanese, and they were a bit rough, but their companions, who were perfectly ordinary constables, treated us politely as they always had done. And the people along the route, those of them who were still in evidence and hadn't fled Kuching, were sympathetic to us. I think they probably took a very dim view of handcuffing us, because that wasn't in the local way of doing things at all. And they weren't going to do anything for us, they couldn't. But I think they kept out of sight as far as they could, or looked the other way.
When you refer to the collaborators being a bit harsh, what exactly do you mean by that?
Well, this business of handcuffing. Mm.
There was no other instance of it.
No. Well, the Eurasian doctor got a bit of rough treatment when he was in the jail in Semangan, in the next door cell to us. But that was a private matter. A chap was paying off an old score. I mean, that was an individual thing between them. It was nothing to do with their attitude to the war, the Japanese, or anything like that.
Yes, I follow. Fine. Now, you referred to being asked a number of questions. Perhaps I could pick up a number of these. Were you asked to give any information about your duties as a district officer?
I simply don't remember what questions we were asked, but I would say that they asked us what we did. In other words, they wanted to know what we were doing in Sarawak. And I imagine that they wanted to know whether we were military or not.
And you made it clear, presumably, what
well,
you
yes,
did.
Well, yes, I was a district officer and magistrate, you know. And they didn't make much of it, as far as that. It hasn't stuck in my memory at all. So there can't have been much to it. Simply identification, really, who we were, what we were up to.
Were you allowed to notify your family at this stage that you had been taken prisoner?
Oh, no. Oh, no, I was incommunicado from then on. As appears from letters that passed between the Sarawak government agent in London and my parents. They kept writing and saying that I was in, they told them where I was and how I could speak the local language, and I was probably all right. And then news began to come in from people who had gone away over the border, who said I was last heard of in such and such a place, and as far as they knew, everything was well. I think it was a long time later, about the middle of 1942, before they ever heard that I was interned. The government agent, in fact, was unable to say anything definite until the end of August 1943 when he had a telegram from Tokyo through the International Red Cross which listed me as one of the prisoners of war.
Fine. Well, we'll move on now, if we may, to your first camp, if we can so glorify the bungalow, at which you spent 6 weeks or so. Can you first of all describe the layout of this little area?
It was the small compound. I don't know the size of it, perhaps 100 feet square, with a small four-room bungalow standing in it, built on piles, with bathrooms down below on the ground, and a very small kitchen annex.
And accommodating how many people?
40 to start with, which then increased with arrivals like myself and, well, us four or five, and other people who were picked up, finally became 60 before we were moved.
And presumably there was no restriction upon your contact with each other in this small space?
Oh, no. But there was restriction, of course, with contact outside. The Japanese who were in charge at that time were, I think, Navy types. And they were much more straightforward than people we had afterwards.
What do you mean by straightforward?
Well, we could understand them a bit better. They were strict, of course. I always imagined that one of the reasons why we didn't feel the worst of being interned at that stage was that the Japanese Navy had been trained by the British Navy. But whether they were Navy or Army in the early stages, they were fighting men. The main difficulties came later when we had reservists, many of whom were in their teens, who were from Taiwan and were not, in fact, fighting men at all. They were simply reserve troops.
And I'll follow up that point later when we deal with the main camp. For now, could you give a very brief description of your daily routine, touching on aspects of food and the contact with the outsiders that you referred to?
One of the first contacts we had, I had, was that my Chinese gardener from Batang turned up one morning, having made his way down, how I don't know, with some more clothes for me and some food, the nature of which I can't remember now. He was chased out, having made his delivery of these goods. He was chased out by the Japanese. And as the local custom is, as he went out of the gate, he offered to shake hands with the Japanese sentry, which would be normal, but to us, Japanese sentry looked him up and down and barked at him. I don't think he actually hit him. And the old man's jaw clamped shut, and he stumped off without another word. He was most offended. I find from looking at some of the records and books that we actually had bread in the camp. The Japanese gave us, amongst other things, a lot of flour that we couldn't do very much with except try our hand at making chapatis. They were dreadful. And finally, we were allowed to send the bread up to the nuns about half a mile away up the road. And they turned it into bread and handed it back to us.
What nationality were the nuns?
I don't know. I didn't know any of them. But I imagine that, like the good fathers, they were Dutch and Austrian and possibly had some local nuns as well.
You referred naturally to a restriction on movement. What sort of level of guard did you have upon you at this stage? What obstacles would there have been to escaping?
Well, there was a barbed wire fence around the place, and there was one sentry on the gate. But it was quite pointless trying to escape, because we'd only then be in the town, and this was in the middle of the town. And we couldn't possibly have got anywhere. Had it been in India, of course, we might very well have got away with it by dressing up as Sikhs or something, which is more possible, but you cannot. The average European simply cannot pass himself off either as a Chinese or as a brown Malay. I mean, they're just different shapes. So we didn't attempt it.
What was morale like at this stage, do you recall?
Pretty good, I think.
Why was this?
We didn't know how long it was going on. We hoped, naturally, it wouldn't be very long. We might have been much more despondent had we known it was going to be nearly 4 years, but we simply didn't know. And the thing was to live as good a life as you could in the circumstances. We were very much in on ourselves, of course, and there were disagreements and tiffs and so forth. We hadn't at that stage got ourselves properly organised.
What sort of issues would come up then that would give rise to dissension at this early stage?
Oh, people taking up too much space or otherwise being inconsiderate or borrowing somebody's valuable piece of soap or something, you know, I mean, silly little things like that. They were sorted, but it was only natural that when you're crowded together like that, you, having not been crowded formerly, you see, we had bungalow like that to ourselves, each of us. In fact, the bungalow was exactly the same design and size as the one I had to myself in Bintulu. And there were 40, between 40 and 60 of them. So naturally there's tension of a sort.
So you transferred after about 6 weeks to your second camp. Could I ask, first of all, how you transferred and where the camp was?
I don't know how we transferred. I think we were probably taken down by lorry, because we went for 1 or 2 days before we finally moved to put up the barbed wire fence. It was a school down the other end of the town and in a swampy area. And we had to, we were required by the Japanese to put our own fence up, which we did. And then after 2 or 3 days, we moved down there, and I imagine they transported us with our belongings by lorry. It was much simpler.